When you started your career in Sweden, what kind of roles were you playing there?
Well, I had already two careers in a way. I mean, I started out as a young actress at the Royal Dramatic Theatre School. I was first a student in the school, and in order to get in there, you have to audition together with a lot of other people, and you're being chosen. And once you're being chosen, the school is supported by the state. And you go in the school for 3 years, and then you, if they want to keep you, you have to stay another 2 years as an actress. Already my second year, was I given the part of a very young schoolgirl, very fresh, very tough. And during the summer, the first 2 summers, where I started to look for work right away. I wanted to get into working. I was only 16 when I started, but I knew that I wanted to get on the stage all the time. So we were allowed to take jobs during the summer. And the first summer, I played the ingenue in one of those touring companies. And I was just the ingenue. But then after that, I was quickly typecast as the sexy. They called it blodfulla Vivica, bloodful Vivica. And, you know, I had very full lips, and I was immediately, you know, put into the sensual and sexy parts. But since my background was of a serious nature, since I was involved in the Royal Dramatic Theatre, my first really big part there was the Bride in Blood Wedding. It's a very sensual woman. But by that time, I had already been discovered for films, and I very quickly became a very big film star in Sweden. And then I was always the very sensual girl, I would say more than sexy, who always attracted all those men and always got into trouble, you know, and would wander from one to another until she found one that understood her or loved her or whatever. So, I mean, in a way, a sex symbol, but since Sweden is not really a corrupt country, and it's a small country, so the sensuality was on a very basic and primitive level. So it was cleaner in a way than here.
How did that carry over into your personal life? Did men always want to meet you and assume that you were an incredibly sensual, sexy person?
It was peculiar because on one hand, I was up on this pedestal being adored and loved, and everybody was turned on by me. But in life, I think I was very shy and had really very little awareness of my weapons as a sensual woman, and never knew how to play that game. So that there was a contradiction in the way I was on the screen and in the way I behaved in life.
You know, sensual people on the screen have all these coy methods and, you know, pouting lips and the longing gaze and
I don't think people really use that much in real life.
No,
I was lucky in the sense that the parts that were written in such a way that I didn't have to do that much.
Oh.
I didn't have to play any games. And I think Swedes are not really interested in, I don't think they know how to play games. In fact, we know that today. We bought the ship. You know, we don't know how to play games. We only know how to be absolutely straight about things. And that was true about that time, too. She, it was not that kind of a sex symbol. It was not like she was trying to get places. But, I mean, it was impossible not to, when it came to getting work, not to use it. It's interesting when you ask, because I didn't think about it, but when I was going in to see a director, I would immediately put on the sexy act. I would give him the whole image, the whole promise of everything that could or could not possibly could happen between us, you know, or on the screen, right? I gave that image immediately. Whereas I think in life, when it came to dealing with a man, I wouldn't know how to do something like that. Maybe in the beginning when you were, you know, turned on and you played the game. But then it was a very basic and primitive game, I think, you know, rather than something you put on.
Was it assumed that if you became a big star in Sweden, it was just a matter of time until you moved to America and made films in Hollywood?
It was the route. The route was to become a famous star in Sweden and then go to Hollywood. It was like at that time, this was during the war, you understand, that I became very big. Partly because we had to create our own film, so there was a much bigger film production going on than before or after the war. It slowed down. We had to satisfy a great deal of many more customers because we couldn't get any films from abroad. So the company that created me began and ended with me. They started with me, they created me, and I became their big star. And in fact, I was very powerful, but I don't think I had any awareness of that power, nor did I have any awareness of that I don't have to go to America to make great films. I can do them here. That was foreign. It was like we had forgotten about the silent motion pictures, which were really great films. And we did not, when I say we, maybe just I, but there was a general sense of that Sweden could not make great films. It was Bergman that sort of started that and proved that, no, a great film can be made any place. But I think the whole world, in a way, suffered from that. And it's only 10 years later that one understood, no, I mean, people can make great films any place. It doesn't have anything to do with the place, you know?
How did you get to America? I was
very big in Sweden, and an agent had seen some of my work, and she was the same agent that had brought Ingrid Bergman over. Sometimes I suspect that she almost felt she wanted to create some more controversy about Bergman by bringing another Swede over. But maybe I'm wrong about that. I never did ask her. But in any event, she sold me to Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers were building me up in the same way that I was going to be another big Swedish, film star. What really had happened was that the world had changed, and that the industry, in a way, had not realized the change, that the women had changed, that the men had changed, that everybody was very influenced by what had happened during the war. And in fact, everybody was desperately trying to get back to a time making films like we had done before the war in Hollywood. But it was a complete change in time. And men and women had gone through something that I think they had no idea about yet, what they had gone through. They had not digested it. Then, of course, very quickly happened the McCarthy period, which really sort of cut the balls on all the vital filmmakers in Hollywood. And, of course, once they did that, the women were victims too. Because if you don't have gutsy, strong men, you don't have gutsy, strong women, you know. So it became the following, I think the 5-6 years that followed after the war were disastrous times. And that's exactly when I came over. And of course, nobody knew what to do with a woman like me at that time because they didn't make films like that anymore. It was suddenly the girl next door or the sex symbol, which is understandable. The man had been in Europe, and the American man had discovered that he didn't have to do anything to have a girl. I mean, he was the hero of the world. He was terribly spoiled, right? So this whole sex symbol image, became very big after the war because they'd had all that sex symbols in Europe. Anybody they wanted would go with them. Then there was the woman next door, the girl next door, right, who should stay home and take care of the children. That's what they dreamt about when they were away. They came home and they wanted to create that again.
Being Swedish, were you supposed to be playing exotic roles? Because foreign accents and exoticism used to go hand in hand in the movies.
That's true. I really admire the American woman. I had seen her on the screen, Katharine Hepburn, Claudette Colbert, Irene Dunne, Barbara Stanwyck. I adored Ginger Rogers. I adored those marvelous American women. I felt they were straight, still they were attractive. It was so few games played. And actually when I came over, I could see that I was in a different box as a European woman. And to some extent, that was an easy road to travel, because I think that the American man or the American producer, in a way, it's interesting that they brought over all those foreign women. They didn't bring over any foreign men. They didn't want any competition in their own house, right? But they didn't mind bringing the women in and sort of threatening the American lady, look, you know, you better behave. Or we got this sexy European broads with us in, right? But I don't think that that was my ambition to be this sexy European broad. I really wanted, you know, to be straight and open and passionate and compassionate. And
what roles were you initially cast in?
I'm sorry?
What roles were you first cast in?
Well, the first film that I did was called Night and Tonight. Where I was playing a widow who fell in love with a man who had some illness. I can't remember what it was now. And that was Ronald Reagan. He played that part. And it was a rather romantic film and not a sentimental film. It was kind of a good film, I think. It was written, the novel was written by Philip Wiley, and the film was really quite a good film. But I think Hollywood had no way, they didn't know what to do with the film, so they put the film aside, and Don Siegel directed it. He was a very young, unknown director at the time. I happened to fall in love with him during the film. So when people asked me about Ronald Reagan, I said I didn't really see Ronnie very much. I had eyes for Don. But anyway, it was not an uninteresting film. But Warner's decided to hold that film, and they were going to, you know, lance me in this other big film with Dennis Morgan and Delma Daves directing it. Richard Brooks was producing it. And that was really a disastrous film, where they were in an area where they really knew nothing about. It was all about blacklisting and being in Paris and being blacklisted. But the Americans really didn't know about all that. In a way, the Italians made much better films about that. So they tried to do a Hollywood film about a European dilemma, and they really didn't succeed. So then they put me in with Errol Flynn, and I played the Spanish Queen. And it was around that time that I began to think, what am I doing here? You know, what am I really doing? I was doing so much better in Sweden. And it took me, of course, many years to understand that they knew much more in Sweden about how to handle me, how to build me up, how to lance me, you know. And I was in a very powerful position in Sweden. But see, I was so unaware of my own power. And I knew so little about how to use it that if somebody said, why don't you do your own films, hiring Ingmar Bergman? And it never would. It was so far away from my horizon to understand that I could do that.
Having played in a film with Ronald Reagan, how do you feel about him as the president now when you turn on your TV and you see him making a speech?
Well, I mean, I'm on the other opposite side of the fence politically. At the time, Ronnie was very radical. You know, he was the president of Screen Actors Guild, and he was a very radically minded man. When he changed, I don't know. Well, you know, I just hate to get into politics. I'm on the other side of the fence. I look at him and I said to myself, he hasn't changed, right? He was very much that way. In those, you really don't quite know what he's thinking. You know that he's expressing things, but you don't absolutely know what he feels, do you? You don't really know. I saw a moment at the memorial services of Sadat. I don't know, you remember that?
Yeah, I didn't get to see much of it.
When they cut to him. It's almost the only time where I've seen Ronnie without a protection, you know, without a mask. And that was kind of moving, I thought.
When you watch him, do you feel like he's acting the part of president or that he is...
Do I feel what?
Do you feel that he's acting the role of president or that he's settled into it and
he's acting Ronald Reagan, you know, always has, you know. And I think it'd be so wonderful if people would stop acting and being trying to get close to... Brecht said a wonderful thing. He says, I love those that change in order to stay themselves. And when I saw him at that memorial service, I thought, well, that was one moment when that was kind of true, you know?
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Vivica Lynforce, and she's written an autobiography which is called Vivica, Vivica. I just recently saw Mommy Dearest, the film about Joan Crawford, and I know you acted with her in a film. I forget
which one it is. Well, I didn't act with her, but when I first came to Hollywood, Jack Warner took me around the studio, you know, introduced me to everybody, and one of the people was Joan Crawford. And she was extremely outgoing and friendly, which was kind of great, I think, since here was this young Swedish woman and obviously sort of the same type as she, certainly could be a threatening, you know, a competition for her. And she showed none of that. And she said immediately, I'd like to give a party for you. And I was stunned and scared. I said, well, a party for me? Who am I? Yeah, I don't know. I was very shy. I wasn't able to handle. I said, I have to live up to all those Hollywood images. I wish I had known that you don't have to live up to it. You know, you can go in your slacks or whatever way. But anyhow, in those days, I didn't. So she did give this party, and it was an extraordinary party where everybody in Hollywood wasn't. I really was barely there. You know that terrible feeling when you're so, you know, uncomfortable, so you feel so, unreal about this whole thing. But it was an extraordinary gesture, an extraordinary party. And then years later, I met her. And I was at that time living in New York. She was living in Hollywood. And I knew at this point the tragedy of her life. I mean, I didn't know anything about the whole thing, about the beating of the children. I don't know anything about that. But I, at this point, I knew that a woman that is of her talent and her intelligence, who ends up selling Pepsi-Cola instead of directing or producing or acting or whatever, that's tragic, you know. And I think I was more aware of it than she. It was like she never allowed to give herself the credit for, no, it's a screw-up world, and I am a victim of this conditioned society. And I don't know what to do about it. I'm defeated. She was defeated, you know. And for somebody with that much talent and that much intelligence, it must have been unbearable, because I don't think she understood why, you see. So she felt completely, you know, rejected. And I said to her, I live in New York. I said, it's much better for a woman actress my age. And I said, maybe you should think of moving. She said, no, no, no. She says, Hollywood is my home. It's the only place. It's the only home I have. And I thought about it a lot. And I thought, if a woman like Crawford had been lucky enough to have had my background, my training, my awareness of the theater, which after all was my first drink of my profession, was the theater. So it was in my blood. And I think that was what saved me, because I knew in a way what had happened to me on the stage, and that is what I wanted to go for. And I knew I couldn't get it in the movies, and I knew I had to go there, and that would be my savior. And if she had had that taste, she would have known where to go to, but she didn't know. She had no awareness of that. She had no knowledge of that. And I think often of how important it is for the young people to at least be exposed to something beyond mediocrity, right? So that they really know what is this all about, right? And so that if things are rough, at least you can go back there, right? But, I mean, none of them did. Crawford didn't. Not even Garbo did. So she was barely exposed to it either. So she felt she had to retire at the age of 40. They accepted those conditions of this century, which was not true but any other century. Sarah Bernhardt, Duse, they could act until they were dropped dead, which is what they did. Yeah. They could act Julie at the age of 60. You can't do that today because the camera has told us so many about so many wrinkles in that face that the illusion is destroyed, you know.
You gave an interview for Life magazine in 1949 that apparently had a pretty dramatic effect on your career. What did you say in the interview about Hollywood?
Well, I had a very ironic and I think witty feeling, or I expressed it too, about the roles that I had played in Hollywood so far, right? Pathetic women, or women that were always, you know, lost in a love affair or something. In a way, I didn't really completely take responsibility for the knowledge that I had about those things, right? Although I did speak up to this press person, that this interview that wrote about me in Life magazine, who called the article "What Happened to Vivica Lindfors?" or "What Happened to Vivica?" whatever. I was on the cover and God knows what, and he was very taken by this very ironic attack that I had on all the parts that I had played. I was right on, you know what I mean? I really was dead right. Now I wasn't so courageous about. Or I wasn't so ready to take responsibility for my impressions, because like two months later I was fired by Warner Brothers. I'm sure it had to do with that article. The article was lying on the pavement, and I got my, you know, notice that they dropped me. And I think that they didn't know what to do with me. They certainly didn't want to deal with anybody that was complicated. They weren't at all interested in that side of me. And I was very interested in the revolutionary side of me. In fact, I liked that part of me almost the best. And I was completely rejected for that. And it was scary in a way, you know, to be rejected for a part of yourself that you really was beginning to discover and take pride in. It was a slap back. And I wish now that I had been less scared when I wasn't accepted by it. I mean, today, if something like that happens, I say, it's their problem. You know, it's not mine. It's too bad. I got to go someplace else, right? I didn't feel that secure in those days. I wasn't as conscious of my strength.
Well, let's jump ahead a few years and talk about one of the recent performances that you toured around the country. And I'm talking about your one-woman show, I'm a Woman.
Yeah.
I assume that show had to do with your own feminism and your own knowledge of feminism. When did that...
It was a very unconscious growth to begin with. I remember that when I was still living in Hollywood. I remember I once went into my agent and... I must have been like 31, maybe 30, 31, and I suggested a part. And he said, yes, we suggested it, but they felt that you were too old. And I couldn't believe it, you know, and I realized that I have to get out of this place because it was such a strong feeling. At that time, I was completely unaware of that I should have asked, what do you mean too old? That's ridiculous. I mean, the guy is... I used to play with a guy. He used to play opposite me. Why isn't he too old? You know, although I might not have gotten any place, but I still should have reacted that way. I mean, today I like myself best when I react and tell them who I am, you know. So when I moved to New York, it was partly to say, I don't want to deal with that whole thing, and I don't believe in it anyhow, right? When I was like 40, 45, and I began to say to myself, I'm never going to do those parts. It is too late. It's going to be too late, right? I said to myself, well, I can do things myself. I don't have to obey the general conditioning of everybody else. And there was a slow awareness of that I could take my life in my own hands. It came, to begin with, it really came by going into analysis. And I went to the Actor's Studio and worked with Lee Strasberg, and he was an enormous influence on me as an actress. It was as if the two things, what I had learned in Sweden and then what I learned from Lee Strasberg, those two forces were exactly what I needed. I could not have learned it only in Sweden. I could not have learned it only in America. It was like those two things really you know, gave me the sense of power that I have as an actress. But he did say something to me one day. He said, "I want to see you, Vivica." And it was no doubt about that this sentence frightened me no end. I barely dared to go back and work with him. That sentence frightened me. So I went into analysis at that time in order to be less afraid if somebody says, "I want to see you." I mean, to be less afraid to be you, right? And it was a wonderful journey. And it was a journey that was perfect for me as an actress at the time. And I write about it in the book. I have a scene called The Stronger that I describe where I'm working with Annie Bancroft. She did go to the shrink. I didn't. And it was like I always would retreat to the same old pattern because I did not dare to show the me that I was discovering more and more was really me, you know.
How do you show yourself when you're in a role? Because actually you're not playing yourself. You're playing somebody else.
You have to always be you. You have to be you and the role, or you have to be you in a particular situation that the role asks for, right? If you play Mother Courage, for instance, which is my favorite, one of my favorite parts, you have to find all the incidents in your life where you have sold out like Mother Courage. You have to identify with that and not feel ashamed of exposing yourself. And most of us go into acting or whatever profession, we go in with a lot of masks, thinking this place I can keep my mask on, right? I can put my best foot forward all the time. But as it happens is that ugly foot keeps wanting to be seen too, you know, and it keeps screwing up the good foot. So unless you accept, no, I'm shitty sometimes. I'm no good sometimes. I'm weak. I'm this, I'm that, right? I can't handle it. You know, I'm incapable, right? And then you begin to put the two things together. The Vivica with the K and the Vivica with the C can be many, many different things. It can be bad, the evil and the good in you. And you accept that you're not absolutely perfect. And then you become a much more naked actress. And then the you will always be there behind the role.
Did finding that self in your acting change your personal life also?
My acting grew along. Well, you see, it's very interesting because you cannot have two separate lives. Whatever you do in your work, you have to do in life. Whatever you do in life, you have to do in your work. So if you want to be this fabulous lady on the stage all the time, you have to somehow be a fabulous lady in life. Otherwise, you begin not to believe this other fabulous, and you begin to undermine your own work all the time, right? So yeah, it has to go both ways. You have to accept the bad and the good inside of yourself so that you grow both as a woman and as an actress. It's got to go hand in hand. And analysis, of course, helps you face things that you, for some reason or another, have repressed and been afraid to expose. Because at that time, maybe nobody understood you, hit you back, and finally decided it's better not to show that part of me, right? I can show it on the stage. I don't dare to show it in life. So when that begins to be allowed to function, both the woman and both the actress is growing. Now, it may be that the people around you will not accept you any longer, don't like that part of you. And, you know, it can lead to breakups. But I think if both people in a relationship grow, then they can only benefit from being yourself, you know.
If you don't mind my asking, I know that at least in a couple of instances you've worked with your husband on projects. Does that work out well? Because I'm sure you know a lot of other people also who've worked in films or plays with their husbands or lovers. And I guess for some people it works, and for some people it doesn't. But how is that experience for you?
I think that whatever is wrong in the marriage will show up. Whatever is good in the marriage and whatever is bad in the marriage will show up when you work, because when you start to work, this honesty has got to be there. You can't fool around any longer. You can't play any games. In acting, you have to be who you are, and you have to speak up, and you have to. But I think that in my relationship with George Tabori, who was, you know, very brilliant writer, that in a way that the things that were allergic, that we were allergic to, I was allergic to, if I was intelligent and outspoken, I was very allergic to not being accepted for that, because as a child I was obviously pushed on because of that, and I was always told that I was dumb. You know, I thought of myself as really being very dumb when I was a child, and that the only thing I had was some kind of a sensuality, and I was emotional, right? But I was dumb. Well, you know, when I began to discover that I was intelligent, it was like a flood broke loose, and I needed to be supported. I was very fragile about this thing. Well, my George was terrific as long as my intelligence would be used against somebody else, or, you know, in order to achieve something with somebody else. But when I would use my intelligence and with him and say, no, you know, I don't understand this line, you know, you're not making sense here, then that was his allergy, that he suffered from the same allergy as I. You know, somebody told him he wasn't as bright as his brother. So that in that sense, our fragilities came out in the work. And I don't know. You know, my feeling is that he couldn't handle it, you know. Mm-hmm. So he finally took off, which was a very turbulent experience in my life. And he left I was 50, and I felt, you know, how can I start all over? How can I find somebody else, et cetera, et cetera. So it was very turbulent. I suppose it was. I suppose what happens to you is what needs to happen. I feel, in a way, now looking back, that it is what I needed. That was almost needed for me in order to really face. No, you got to. The enemy is not somebody else. The enemy is you. You have to strengthen this allergic quality in you. And if he doesn't understand me or supports me in this thing, I have to laugh and say, well, it's too bad, right? Hopefully he'll come around. Maybe he won't ever. I can still love him. That I was incapable of doing that. It was like I was so fragile towards mm-hmm. his support. Mm-hmm. And I suppose he was equally fragile towards my support.
I regret that we're running a little short on time, but what kind of roles are you interested in doing now? In film or stage?
Well, I'm interested in all roles. I think I would rather answer it this way. I'm interested to be part of things that are above mediocrity. I'm not interested in mediocrity. I have to do it in order to survive. But I'm primarily interested in superb writing, superb quality work, things that will heighten us, that will lift us above a mediocre level. I think mediocrity is the enemy of our time, and we are surrounded by it, you know, on television, on radio, in film, on the stage. It's like we're accepting it to such an extent it's beginning to be shocking. Somebody, a young actress who graduated from the American Academy in Arts, or whatever it's called, had never heard of Lorca. And I said to myself, how can you go through a school where the parents have to pay thousands of dollars and they don't teach you? You have to read Lorca, you have to read Shakespeare, you have to read Homer, you have to, you know, read Brecht. It's part of being an actress. And it's like, that's what I'm in for. And whether I'm a teacher doing it or whether I am a director, and I want to direct very much, but I really want to direct very much because there's not enough parts for me to play. There's not enough interesting, great women parts for anybody my age, right? And when I say my age, I don't feel limited. I feel I can play anything from 30 to 100, you know. But we're stuck, you know what I mean?
Yep.
We're stuck in images.
Well, I wish you the best, and I want to thank you for telling us a little bit about your life. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.